Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI. Welcome, everyone. Today we're diving deep into Umberto Eco's, well, massive 1980 debut, The Name of the Rose. Now, you might know it as this, you know, gripping 14th century murder mystery, but it's so much more underneath. It's really a profound look at things like censorship, knowledge itself, and ultimately, the limits of human reason.
It really is quite unique. Eco himself was this major intellectual figure, wasn't he? A semiotician, philosopher, medieval scholar.
Right.
And somehow he managed to weave all that academic weight into an international bestseller. Quite something.
We probably need to unpack that academic side right away because it feels so, well, central to what the book is doing. What does it actually mean that Eco was a semiotician? How does that play out in the story?
Good question. Yeah. So a semiotician studies signs and symbols, you know, how we interpret them, how they create meaning. And William of Baskerville, our protagonist, he's basically doing that in the 14th century. He's constantly trying to read the signs, whether that's like hoof prints in the snow outside the abbey or cryptic codes on a desk or even just the social dynamics within the monastery.
So that changes everything, doesn't it? We're not just watching a detective hunt for clues in the usual sense. It's more like a philosophical investigation into meaning itself.
Exactly. And that complexity is probably why the book became such a landmark of postmodern literature. It's packed with what academics call intertextuality.
Texts referencing other texts.
Precisely. Texts building on each other, layers upon layers of historical references, literary puzzles. It's dense.
And the setting feels perfectly chosen for this kind of intellectual puzzle box.
Oh, absolutely. A remote Benedictine monastery, northern Italy, November 1327, and you have this backdrop of huge political turmoil in the church. This fierce debate about the poverty of Christ.
Pitting the Pope against reformists like the Franciscans.
Right, including William. And the whole thing is told as a memory piece, you know, through the eyes of the elderly Adso of Melk, looking back on this one intense week when he was young.
Okay, so let's set the scene for the mission. William of Baskerville arrives with his novice, Adso. They're there for a theological debate, officially.
But they get pulled into a murder investigation almost immediately. A monk has died under suspicious circumstances.
And that central tension snaps into place right away, doesn't it? William's approach, reason, observation, deduction, clashing with the, well, the absolute authority of the church, an authority often based on fear.
William really embodies that spirit of inquiry. People often compare him to Sherlock Holmes, and you can see why. The logic, the sharp observation, he even wears spectacles.
Which were cutting-edge technology then, a real symbol of seeing clearly, scientifically.
Exactly. And he's a former inquisitor himself, which adds another layer. He knows firsthand how that kind of dogmatic power works and its dangers.
So his journey isn't just about solving the murders.
Not entirely. It's maybe more about intellectual humility. He arrives thinking reason can untangle anything, but the events of the week teach him some hard lessons about the limits of logic when faced with pure fanaticism.
And Adso of Melk is with him through all this.
Adso is our narrator, yes. He's the emotional heart of the story for the reader. It's very much a Bildungsroman for him, a coming-of-age story.
Right.
He starts out quite innocent, obedient. But this week, it throws him into a spiritual crisis. Intellectual shock awakens him to the world's complexities, its darkness, all under William's guidance.
And against them, you have this force of opposition embodied in one character, Jorge of Burgos.
Ah, Jorge, the blind, elderly librarian. Spanish. He's formidable.
His blindness, it's obviously symbolic, right? It's a kind of willful ignorance.
Absolutely. A refusal to see anything, any truth, any new knowledge that might challenge the established dogma. His whole purpose seems to be suppressing certain kinds of knowledge.
And the library is his domain.
Oh, the library is almost a character itself. It's described as this huge labyrinth, a fortress built inside a tower. It's a place where knowledge is hoarded, yes, but also actively hidden, suppressed.
Making the search for truth literally dangerous.
A dangerous act of rebellion, you could say. The path to the library's deepest secrets is guarded by riddles, architectural tricks. It's designed to keep people out.
Okay, let's follow William and Adso into this maze as the bodies start piling up. You mentioned the structure follows the canonical hours of monastic life.
Yes, Eco uses that rhythm, Batons, Lauds, Prime, Terse, and so on, to structure the days. It gives this strange, almost liturgical cadence to the unfolding horror.
So, day one, William arrives and almost immediately impresses everyone by deducing where the abbot's lost horse went just by reading the signs.
Classic William. A flash of brilliance. But then reality hits. Adelmo, a young manuscript illuminator, is found dead. Fell from the library tower, apparently.
But William suspects it's not that simple.
Right. He notices inconsistencies straight away. Suicide seems too neat an explanation.
And day two.
The pattern, or what seems like a pattern, begins.
Yeah.
Venantius, who translated Greek texts, is found dead. Drowned in a vat of pig's blood.
Gruesome. And there's a clue.
Yes. A cryptic note in Greek on his desk. This immediately links the deaths to forbidden books in the library. And crucially, the monks start whispering, connecting the deaths to the seven trumpets of the apocalypse from the book of Revelation.
Which is the false trail William will follow for a while.
Exactly. He gets caught up in interpreting that pattern.
Okay, days three and four, things escalate.
They do. The official theological debate begins, bringing in papal legates. The political tension ramps up. And then another death. Berengar, the assistant librarian, is found drowned in a bath.
Confirming the apocalyptic pattern in the monk's eyes.
Mm-hmm. It seems like an elaborate, almost ritualistic series of murders.
But amidst all this heavy intellectual and political stuff, there's a very human moment for Adso.
Ah, yes. Adso's encounter with the peasant girl. He gets lost, finds himself outside the abbey walls, and meets this nameless young woman.
It's a pivotal moment for him, isn't it?
Absolutely devastating in a way. It's this brief, intense flash of, well, of human connection, desire, reality. Completely different from the abbey's strict intellectual world. It shatters his innocence. He never forgets her.
A powerful contrast. But the outside world, the world of power and politics, crashes back in pretty quickly.
It does. Day five brings the arrival of Bernardo Gui, the Inquisitor.
And he's an old adversary of William's.
Yes. And he represents the complete opposite of William's approach. Gui isn't interested in evidence or reason in the way William is.
He has an agenda.
Totally. His goal isn't finding the truth of the murders. It's confirming his own suspicions, rooting out heresy, reinforcing church authority. He operates through intimidation, torture.
And this is where things get really dark for some characters.
Horribly so. Gui rounds up suspects, including the poor peasant girl Adso met, and some marginalized monks like Salvatore and Remigio, and uses force to get the confessions he wants.
It's a stark moment for William, isn't it? Seeing the limits of his rational methods.
It's brutal. His logic, his careful deductions, they're just useless against this kind of systematic oppression, this raw institutional power that has already decided who is guilty.
So how does the investigation proceed from there?
Well, William has to rely on his own persistence, really.
Yeah.
Moving into days six and seven, Malachi, the head librarian, suddenly collapses and dies during prayers.
Another one? How?
His tongue is stained black. It's clearly poison. This gives William a crucial clue about the method. And finally, painstakingly, he cracks the library's secret, the riddles, the mechanism leading to the hidden room, the Finis Africa.
The end of Africa? The forbidden heart of the library?
Exactly. And there he confronts Jorge of Burgos.
The final showdown. And Jorge reveals everything.
Yes, he confesses. He orchestrated the deaths. Not all of them directly, perhaps, but he set the trap. He poisoned the pages of one specific book.
Which book? Why?
This is the big reveal. It's the legendary lost second book of Aristotle's Poetics, the book that supposedly dealt with comedy, with laughter.
Laughter? He killed people to stop them reading about comedy. That seems extreme.
It is. But Jorge's reasoning is chillingly absolute. He believes laughter kills fear, specifically the fear of God. And without that fear, he thinks, faith collapses.
So any knowledge that promotes laughter, that undermines solemn authority, must be destroyed.
Precisely. It's the ultimate expression of dogmatic control, protecting faith by destroying knowledge he deems dangerous.
It's a powerful symbol. Eco isn't necessarily saying this specific book would have toppled Christianity, is he?
No, probably not literally. It stands for something bigger. Jorge fears the freedom that comes with questioning, with humor, with challenging sacred cows. Ego's using it to critique fanaticism, the kind that prioritizes absolute certainty over open inquiry.
So laughter, like reason, is presented as a liberating force.
Exactly. Something to be celebrated, not suppressed. A path towards, well, maybe a more human kind of understanding.
Okay, so if we pull back, we see this core conflict, reason versus faith, or maybe reason versus dogmatism. But you mentioned there's a huge irony in how William actually solves the case.
Yes. This is one of Ico's brilliant twists.
Yeah.
It's about the interpretation of signs again. Mm. William does figure out the mechanics, the poison, the location, or his motive using his deductive skills. Mm-hmm. But he ultimately realizes he was following a false trail for much of the investigation. That whole pattern, based on the seven trumpets of the apocalypse.
Yeah.
It wasn't Jorge's plan at all. William imposed that pattern onto events that were actually a mix of accidents, passions, Jorge's specific interventions. It was a coincidence that things seemed to fit.
Wow. So he solved it partly by mistake, by finding a pattern that wasn't really there.
That's what he concludes. He says something like, "There was no plot, and I discovered it by mistake." It's this incredible moment of intellectual humility from the great rationalist.
That's a profound point about how we try to make sense of the world. We impose patterns.
We do. And Eco, while championing reason, is also showing its limits. Reality is messier, more chaotic than our theories sometimes allow. And then, of course, comes the climax.
Jorge won't let the book survive.
No. Cornered, he starts eating the poison pages himself and then sets fire to the library.
Destroying everything.
The entire repository of knowledge. Centuries of irreplaceable manuscripts go up in flames. It's an absolute catastrophe, a true tragedy representing the horrific cost of fanaticism.
That image, the burning library, is unforgettable. The loss feels immense.
It signifies the fragility of human culture, the potential for knowledge to be wiped out by rigid ideology.
Which brings us to that haunting final line, adso, looking back years later.
Stet rosa pristina nomine, nomina nuda tenemus.
The primordial rose exists only in its name. We possess naked names. What do you think Eco meant by ending with that?
It's so layered. On one level, it's adso mourning loss, the girl, the library, William, his youth. Everything physical is gone, turned to dust. All that's left are the names, the words, the memories.
But for Eco, the semiotician, names and words are powerful, right?
Immensely powerful. So even in loss, there's a hint that something endures. The idea, the sign, the story itself. Language becomes the fragile vessel holding onto meaning after reality fades. It's melancholy, but maybe not entirely hopeless.
Thinking about why this story still grips us today, it feels incredibly relevant, doesn't it? This struggle against censorship, against the suppression of ideas.
Definitely. And the need for critical thinking, for questioning the narratives we're given, especially now in an age overflowing with information and misinformation.
The novel seems to argue that knowledge is always incomplete, always provisional, but the courage to seek it anyway, and maybe the humility to laugh at our own certainties, that's what matters.
That feels right. That combination of intellectual curiosity and intellectual humility seems key. The willingness to keep searching, even knowing you might never have the final answer, and resisting those who claim they already do.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.